And if we can now, we'll have panel two. That's Dr. Richard Klausner and Dr. Francis Collins. Dr. Klausner was recently appointed by President Clinton to be the director of the National Cancer Institute. We're delighted that you're here this morning. Dr. Francis Collins is the director of the National Center for Human Genome Research at NIH. And again, we appreciate your being here this morning, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, and thank you, both of you, Senator Mack and Senator Feinstein, for both having this cancer coalition and inviting us here. And I'm delighted to appear here as the new director of the National Cancer Institute. I'm particularly pleased that you've chosen to have a hearing on genetic testing in cancer. As you alluded to, we are in the midst of an extraordinary revolution in science, a revolution that is undoubtedly going to change medicine. However, we're at the very beginning of that revolution. We have an enormous distance to go. There are a tremendous number of questions that we still must answer, and as you said, we actually now have more questions than we have answers. We also all recognize that the types of issues that are being raised by these changes in how we view ourselves and how we approach issues such as risk and what risks an individual carries into and through life, there are tremendous implications for individuals and for society at large. Cancer will be diagnosed in approximately one out of every three Americans over the course of their lifetime, and one out of every five Americans will die of cancer. By the end of this century, cancer will be the number one cause of death of Americans. What we need to do, and what the goal of the National Cancer Institute is to reduce the terrible burden that cancer takes from individuals, from families, from communities. We need to do that by learning about what causes cancer and what the nature of cancer is. We need to understand and to test and to develop preventions, screenings, diagnoses, and treatments. And it's only if we focus, and we do focus, as you know, on all of those aspects, that we will be successful in reducing the burden of cancer. But we want to know, and everyone wants to know, who actually is at risk for cancer? What determines risk? Who gets which of the over 100 different diseases that we call cancer? And what we're here today to talk about is one aspect of risk. That is that individuals, many individuals, carry with them, based upon their inherited genetic script, an increased risk for a variety of cancers. Now, the importance of defining risk, we can see, for example, in understanding the risk that attends smoking. By defining risk, we often define not only what can cause cancer, but what we can do to prevent it. With the definition of genetic risk for cancer, we hope, and this is a hope, that that information can be used not only as a window to understanding the causes of cancer and the genetic basis of cancer, but of course that that information can be used to the benefit of patients. That we hope that by identifying individuals at particular risk for the development of particular cancers, we will have preventions that are effective. We will have screening and diagnostic procedures that would be effective. But this largely remains a hope. In order to understand a little bit about what we're all here to discuss, let me describe a little bit about what we now are beginning to understand cancer as being. We now view cancer, all cancer, as essentially a genetic disease. Now, it's important to distinguish a genetic disease, a disease defined by abnormalities in genes, from an inherited disease. For the vast majority of cancers, they arise because in an individual there is a gradual accumulation of changes, alterations, we call mutations, in what really is probably just a handful of the 100,000 genes that entirely encode a human being. These changes develop in a cell over the course of the lifetime of an individual, and it takes time. This is one of the reasons that cancer is a disease primarily of aging. This recognition that cancer is fundamentally a disease of genetic changes has profound implications for what we do in the National Institutes of Health and what the biomedical community needs to do in terms of understanding cancer. It's led to one of the most extraordinary hunts in the history of biomedical science, the hunt for those genes that are cancer and cancer-causing or cancer predisposition genes. Furthermore, each cancer is actually defined by the particular fingerprint of genetic changes that define its behavior, and we assume defines whether it's been relatively benign or aggressive and what its responses to different therapies will be. So a great challenge for us is to identify those genes that actually define what each cancer is. Now, while we talk about cancer as a genetic disease, it is only an inherited disease in the minority of cases. For the most common cancers, about 10%, for example, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer, kidney cancer, melanoma, ovarian, we now know that in about 10% of cases, these represent cases that arise in families with extremely high incidences of cancer. Families that we refer to as having familial cancer syndromes, where we can think about the development of cancer as the manifestation of an inherited genetic disease like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease. Over the past year or two, there has been enormous progress in identifying the genes that are responsible within particular high-risk families for conferring to particular individuals this high propensity to develop cancer. These genes that have been defined include some of the genes that are responsible in these families for breast and ovarian cancer, for kidney cancer, for colon cancer, for, as you said, melanoma, and for others. And there are more yet to be found. Now, while these the inherited forms of cancer only represent the minority of cancers, because cancer is so common, a lot of people in the United States carry predisposing genetic changes that predispose them to the development of cancer. It's been estimated that perhaps...
Could I interrupt you for just a moment, just make sure we're at least I'm hooked into what you're saying?
Sure.
As I understand it, there may be specific genes that you may inherit that in essence are mutated that will give you a higher probability of cancer.
That's right.
But there are also other genes that you could be carrying that at some time during your life will mutate.
That's right.
And those are the genes you're referring to that give you a higher predisposition.
Now, let me explain better. In most cancers that we call sporadic, that are not clearly inherited, the changes of genes that are responsible for a cell itself changing from a normal, well-behaved cell to a cancer cell are acquired. In every cell in our body, in the course of a day, there may be thousands of mutations that happen. That's normal. That's what happens. It's due to internal stresses, to environmental stresses, etc. What's important is that in every cell of the body, we have very effective mechanisms to recognize those changes and to correct those changes. In fact, it appears that the AT gene is a gene whose function it is to recognize damage in DNA and to be part of fixing that damage. Cancer arises when there's an imbalance between the ongoing damage that DNA experiences and the ability of the cell to fix it.
Can I stop you too?
Mm-hmm.
Just in your statement, and I can't get my mind off this, you say we now know that cancer all cancers are genetic diseases.
Yes, meaning that the nature of a cancer cell is determined by changes in the genes of that cancer cell. So all cells in our body carry the genes throughout life, but they're not, that doesn't mean those changes are inherited.
Can you say caused by genetics?
Well, they are caused by changes to the genes, and that results in the change of the function that these particular genes provide to each cell, and it's when those functions are changed or lost that the normal controls over cell growth and division, the normal controls over cells being well behaved as part of a tissue, break down and are lost, and now the cells grow without control and spread. And so it is due to changes in genes within a cell that cancer arises. Now, some individuals begin life with one of those genes already changed. What we refer to that is they have a first hit. So it means they already begin with one of the changes that's going to have to take place somewhere in some cell already happening. So they will develop cancer at a much higher frequency because fewer additional changes have to take place throughout life in a particular cell in order for cancer to develop. That's why in families that have these inherited cancer syndromes, that inherit one defective copy of what we call a cancer predisposition gene, or we also call it a tumor suppressor gene, because its normal function seems to be to protect the cell, to suppress the possibility of the release of controls that allow cancer to develop. If you inherit one damaged copy, your risk of eventually getting a cancer goes way up. But not everyone that has this predisposition develops it. It's not a guarantee, it simply increases your risk. Now, in some families, that risk can be as high as 90% over the lifetime of an individual if they inherit one of these tumor suppressor genes in an abnormal form in these families. As I said, while only the minority of cancers are the result of inheriting one of these known damaged genes or altered genes, it does still represent a large number of individuals. Greater than 1 million individuals in the United States inherit a defective form of a gene that predisposes to colon cancer. Probably about the same number of individuals inherit a defective form of one of several genes that may predispose, that does predispose to breast cancer, and on. So it is a big issue, even though it is the minority of cases that of patients that develop cancer that have actually inherited a defined gene, a gene that we potentially can test for. Inherited differences in genes can be tested for because those changes in the genes are carried in all cells of our body, including blood cells. And so, potentially, we do not have to wait in order to identify that change in a cancer cell, because in all cells in the individual, that change is already present in the DNA. But saying that, saying we can potentially test for these genetic predispositions, is much easier than actually doing it. And why is that? First of all, we don't know yet all of the genes. We have not yet defined all of the genes that may give an individual an increased risk, a predisposition to a particular type of cancer. Second of all, it's technically extremely challenging to look for these changes. As I'm sure Francis will tell you, genes can be thought about as a book or a very long word made up of often thousands, and in some cases millions, of letters. The mutations that we're talking about are misspellings in those words. And that misspelling in a particular gene can happen anywhere in this very long, thousands and thousands of letters anywhere. You can imagine then the ability to scan these entire genes to look for a misspelling when we don't know which misspelling to look for is an enormous technological challenge. And that provides a tremendous challenge to us to develop the technology, but it also provides right now a tremendous limitation in the ability to technically, readily, feasibly, and in a cost-effective way, identify these mutations. This is one of the reasons that, as you saw in the Washington Post, perhaps this morning, Dr. Collins and I yesterday announced the discovery of a mutation, a change in a breast cancer susceptibility gene called BRCA1, in which in one population, that is the Ashkenazi Jewish population, that are Jews whose ancestors come from Central or Eastern Europe, about 1% of that population appears to carry a specific misspelling at a specific and known place in this very long BRCA1 word. The importance of that discovery is that now we know where in this tremendous word to immediately go in that population and look for the misspelling, and it raises the possibility, technically, that it would be feasible to screen such a population. Feasible, but we're not ready. What are the types of questions that we have to deal with in terms of genetic screening for cancer predisposition?
Before you get into that, let me just go back to the what you just kind of run through of the BRCA1 gene and the letters. As I remember, there are something like over 5,000
That's right.
Sequences or letters in the BRCA1 gene. And you've also, at this point, I think there are 60 identified mutations, and I suspect there's probably 100 at this point, but not all are published yet. And you were really talking about one mutation in this issue of Ashkenazi Jews.
That's right. That's
and,
right.
And only one specific test.
That's right.
For a mutation for BRCA1. Is that right?
So that's right.
So that's how
narrowed.
We've taken a rather large issue and narrowed it down now to where there's one specific mutation on the BRCA1 gene which you can specifically test for now.
That's right.
Okay.
And you can see how much easier that is to go and say, I know exactly where to look
right.
for this mutation.
Let me tell you what
for.
Our situation is. We I think we're going to have two back-to-back votes. That was the call for the first one. Which means we've probably got another 10 minutes that we could go.
Yeah, let's do that
and then we'll recess and come back. So
okay.
I will let you decide whether you want to take that all 10 minutes or whether you want to, or just how the two of you want to handle this. There's plenty, when we
well,
come
you,
back.
You will come back. So let me try to quickly.
We'll give Dr. Collins plenty of time, so don't feel like that you have to rush.
It won't be great.
Okay, well, let me just quickly talk about the types of issues that we need to deal with, and several panelists will be talking about many of the issues. We need to be answering questions about who we will eventually screen. Will we be screening only individuals that we predetermine to be at high risk because they're members of particular high-risk families? Will we be screening subpopulations, or will we ever get to the point where it would be reasonable and effective to screen entire populations? These are answers we don't know, questions we don't know the answers to. Importantly, what will we do with the information when a change in a cancer susceptibility is found? How will it help, not help, or even harm an individual that might receive this information? And finally, of course, how will we as a society deal with the ethical, legal, social insurance, and psychological issues of the information that we are developing? So where do we go from here? Well, I want to just touch on a few issues that we need to address, some of the technical, the infrastructure, the scientific issues. I will leave it to others in the panel to talk about many of the ethical, legal, and social issues. First of all, there is much more to do in basic science. There are more genes to be discovered. We need to understand the function of those genes. Each of these genes that we identify as cancer susceptibility genes provide extraordinary windows of opportunity to understand cancer itself, what causes it, what is the nature of cancer, what are the properties of those cancers. What we are talking about today represents undoubtedly the tip of the iceberg of genetic contributions to cancer. Right now, we are talking simply about, currently, looking at cancer susceptibility genes when a single gene is altered and it gives an increased chance and risk of developing cancer. We recognize that ultimately in an individual, the contributions of multiple genes that modify the effect of other genes. We need to look at the influence of behavior, of nutrition, of the environment on the expression of those genes and on the risk of developing cancer, even if you carry those genes. We need to develop a lot more technology so that we can more readily identify mutations, alterations in genes when we know that particular genes perhaps should be looked for in families or in patients. We need to pay attention to all the challenges of ultimately reducing these sorts of testings from a research tool to clinical practice. Issues such as validation of tests, of the quality of tests, of knowing what's the probability that a test gives a false positive or a false negative. We need to understand the best technology so that the tests are reliable and affordable. Most importantly, we as a research community need to answer the many crucial, most crucial questions about what it means to have an altered cancer susceptibility gene. What does a particular mutation mean? What is actually the risk? Over what age span? What modifies that risk? We need to know, what can we do? Was surveillance effective, such as mammography or other types of surveillance, if on affecting individuals? We need to know what the optimum healthcare, optimum therapies are for individuals that have these mutations. For that, we need clinical research. We need to pay attention to our infrastructure, our research infrastructure. We need to redouble our efforts to make sure that the clinical research infrastructure that's required specifically to address these sorts of questions, such as databases, family registries, epidemiologic studies, DNA and tissue banks, informatics that allow individuals throughout the country and throughout the world to share information. We need to pay attention to genetic counseling, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that. We need to pay attention to education. Education not only of consumers, but of providers. We're talking about a whole new type of medicine, and we need to make sure that all participants in the medical community, providers and consumers, have the information they need to make decisions, and we are working on that. This is just one example. We'll be coming out with the Cancer Institute and the National Center for Human Genome Research is putting together a booklet for the public on understanding gene testing, and we'll be working in many ways to deal with increasing education. And finally, we will need to deal with the infrastructure, such as cancer genetic clinics. We need to have people trained so that they can develop and run cancer genetic clinics. We need to have all of the personnel in place and available in terms of patient education and counseling and ethics, working with medical oncologists and others in order to provide ultimately first the research and then ultimately the clinical services so that our discoveries, as I said, eventually actually affect in a positive way the life of individuals and of patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that probably it makes sense for us to go ahead and go to the Senate floor. It'll be some time since there will be two votes.